Welcome to the oh my god. Welcome to the Creative Nonfiction Podcast. I'm your host, Brendan O'Mara. Before I drop the Andre DeBuse the Third bomb onto your tympanic membranes, that's your eardrums. Love to see my useless biology degree at work, by the way. Andre knows his stuff, and he's super grounded and takes the responsibility of a writer who has, quote-unquote, made it very seriously. He knows that sometimes that little bit of encouragement from someone in his position could fuel a budding writer for years. He knows. It happened to him at one point. He talks about his amazing memoir, Townie, which came out in 2011, the joy in writing, how he wrote his breakout novel, The House of Sand and Fog, his love of the essay, dealing with rejection, the power of revision, and how he's written 5 to 6 days a week for 35 years. Man, there's just so much jammed in here. We need to go. We need to go now. But first, let's do some housekeeping. Please subscribe if you haven't already. And if you've gotten any value from the podcast, please share it and leave a review on iTunes. I've been leaving reviews for podcasts like Jessica Leahy's Am Writing Podcast and Writing Class Radio, and it literally takes 60 seconds. 5 stars, little comment, done. And you've helped so, so much. You have no idea. So enough of that. Let's lay down the riff and get on to it. Episode 54 with Andre DeBuse the Third. Let's start by talking about the River Teeth memoir contest that you judged recently. Yeah. And I imagine that, you know, you got a lot of that stuff in your lap. And what was a big takeaway from a lot of the stuff that came to your desk when you were judging that? Like, what did you see what was sort of the pulse of memoir that you got to read through judging that contest?
Well, that's a great question. I've done that, I think, a couple of times. And, well, sure, first let me back up, give you more context.
Sure.
So, you know, before I wrote my own accidental memoir, Townie, I had not actually read a lot of memoirs. I did read, thank you, Doc. I did read This Boy's Life by Tobias Wolff years ago, and that was sort of a kind of artistic model for me. What I'm getting at is a lot of people are writing really well about their lives. You know, there's a lot. Now, look, I got some of the finalists and semifinalists. The takeaway is it's hard to write a memoir. Look, all writing is hard in all ways at all times, which is what I think writers love about it. I found that once again that the task seems to be to write honestly and fairly, but also you're walking that fine line between self-aggrandizement and self-pity. And it's got to be an honest book. And that's hard to do. I'm not being articulate here. I have found that once again, the best books seem to be the ones where the writer had command of his or her material emotionally. In other words, there'd been enough distance between the thing being written about and the thing that had happened. And those that seem to be too close to the events they're writing about tended to fall into the self-aggrandizement and or self-pity traps, which are understandable. I'm not saying I'm above it, but I'm saying that's one of my central sort of observations.
Right, and that's, you know, something you were certainly able to accomplish with Townie, because you did have 30 years removed from so much of the narrative of that book. So yeah, like, and maybe like speak to that a little more, just that importance of distance so you can process it with a clearer set of glasses.
Mm-hmm. And I really like what you just said, a clearer set of glasses that comes with time. Yeah. You know, I teach undergraduates at UMass and I talk to a lot of college students around the country all year long. And I'm always amazed when I meet a 20, 21 year old human being who's writing a memoir or, you know, a bunch of personal essays, and you know, they, it's not their fault. They're only, you know, 18 months, 3 years, 5 years removed from what they're writing about. And I tell them, you know, I had to get 30, 40 years down the road. So much of what is in Townie, I try to write as fiction three separate times over about 28 years of my writing life. Huh. Probably for a total of maybe 8 or 9 writing years, I try to write so much of what's in there as a novel. And it finally came as nonfiction, and it came from an essay I was writing about my sons in baseball. And the question fueling the essay was, how come I didn't play baseball? I love baseball now, but I got into it when my kids got into it. I'm 40 years old. How did this happen? So that's what began. But you're right. It took 30-something years before I could actually go back to those wounds of my childhood and really write about them honestly and fairly and clearly.
And what was that experience like watching your sons play ball? And what were the thoughts going through your head as you were watching them play, and then as you were looking to process that to write about an essay?
Well, so much of it was, are you a dad yet?
No.
I highly recommend it if it's in the cards for you guys. There's nothing better. There's just nothing better. And the primary feeling, one of joy, you know, it's just so joyous to watch these creatures that came out of you and your partner and having their lives of their own. And so the feelings were, it was interesting, mainly fatherly, a sense of wanting them to have a safe and, you know, positive experience with youth sports and all that. But there's also the little boy in me, you know, I do believe, and this is not an original thought, of course, that, you know, we're all like the skins of an onion. Like, I'm 57 years old, but, you know, my 14-year-old self is talking to you right now. Your 20-year-old self is talking to me. We're all, it seems to me that all parts of us are here at all times, and we can't get away from it, which is kind of beautiful. And so, yeah, there's a part of the little boy in me who, you know, I move 2-3 times a year for cheaper rent. We're always the new kid in schools, and we got picked on. You know, I avoided sports because I didn't know anything about them. I got teased. And so it brought back the rejected, exiled little boy I'd been. But the irony is, it turns out I was a pretty athletic kid, but I became a solo athlete as a, you know, weightlifter, runner, boxer kind of guy. But all of that was there. There was the little boy in me wishing I played, but mainly the father in me proud and happy to see my boys taking part, you know, and using their bodies and not being afraid of what people said to them.
Mm. And, you know, you wrote this great essay, The Descent, in the latest issue of River Teeth. And I wonder, like, how can a writer make that descent into the dream world, as you write about in nonfiction, like someone can in fiction? You know,
I'm so glad you asked. So look, as you probably know, the opposite of the word to remember is not forget; it's dismember. It's chop, chop, chop. You know, and so when we're remembering, we're literally putting the pieces back together again. I mean, look at what a therapist does. I've read. I've been there. What do? They say, okay, where were you sitting? Well, I was in the kitchen. Well, was he still in his winter coat? Yeah. And was it still snowing out? Yeah, it was really coming down. You know, they're real, the questions are all leading you to put the images together to tell the story again. And I think that's what we do in memoir. Now, I do believe that people make, and well, by the way, this is also another central thing I took away from judging the River Teeth contest, memoir contest, is that too often you feel that the writer knows too much about what he or she is hoping and trying to say with their memoir. And my view is, well, just because you were there doesn't mean you know what the hell happened. You know, we all know that when we were 16 years old, our dad left our mother and, you know, he did some time. You know, we all know what that, you know, I'm making this up, but but just because we know what happens, what the hell happened, right? So it seems to me that if journalism is about information, art, the kind that we do, is about experience. You know, journalism is about recording. What we do is about capturing. You know, journalism is about the facts. Ours is about the truth. And so I think that, you know, a guy who mainly writes fiction, but I will write personal essays now and then, and I've written that memoir, I feel the same fuel at work, which is curiosity. And I think that is the main challenge, is you must be curious about what happened to you. Just because you were there doesn't mean you know what the hell happened. And I would submit to you, that's really why you're writing this memoir. Because you have to go back, because what the fuck happened?
Right. You know? Yeah, so you have to kind of be...
You have to go back into the wreck, which is actually from a great Adrian Rich poem, right?
Yeah.
You have to go back into the wreck.
Yeah, and you're an incredible repository of quotes from great writers. Like, I'm always impressed. You seem to be able to recall them just at the snap of a finger. And is that something you record and you play over in your head and how do you, you've got those like right in your holster, it seems. So it's like
it's funny. People say I have like a weird savant quality about it. The truth is, I have a weird memory. Like Brendan, buddy. I could watch a movie tonight by Labor Day. New movie for me. I won't remember anything. But I do retain lyrics and quotes and lines. It's just the nature of my memory. I retain words that I love that are helpful to me. And they just, I don't memorize them. I have tried to memorize a poem or two, but that's all. But it's funny, my wife says, oh, honey, you have no wisdom of your own. It's just like a Rolodex of other people's wisdoms. I said, well, I call that attribution.
So one of the great things that in the acknowledgments that you wrote in Townie is I think you were crediting your editor or thanking your editor about helping to find the true book within the one you'd first written. What was that process like, trying to... keep going deeper and deeper to find that true book.
I'm glad you asked about that because, I feel so fortunate to have her as an editor. Actually, today, after I get off with you, I'm sending my new novel to her, today.
Oh, congratulations. That's awesome.
Well, thank you, man. She's a toughie, and she's very smart, and she's very rigorous. A really good editor will help you do that. And, he or she is not looking to help you write a more commercial book. They are actually looking at what it is you've wrought and helping you write it even more fully and in a truer way. So here's the thing. When I first drafts, I left out all my family. I left them out. I didn't want to shine a light on their privacy. I didn't know where the line was. And she said the funniest thing. So I sent her all this violent stuff, which I was happy to write about because I've been trying to write about street violence for years. I didn't know how to do it without sounding dangerous and strange. And I found, the truth, right? Mm-hmm. How did I find my way into the violence? Through the scared little boy who didn't know anything about sports, who moved with his single mother and siblings to tough towns. And that was the way in. And the more honest way in, the more vulnerable way in. And so the first drafts, I had all the street violence. She said, well, didn't you live with people? I said, yeah. Well, isn't that part of your story too? I said, yeah, but I don't want to violate their privacy. So a little while later, I saw the writer Richard Russo. He's a good buddy, and we were at this literary thing, and this is before he'd written his own memoir elsewhere. And I told him, I said, I know my editor is right. I just don't know where the line is between me and my family's experience. And he said the most helpful thing I've heard about this. He said, well, if it were me, I'd ask myself, am I trying to hurt anyone with this book? Am I trying to settle any scores? And if the answer is yes, I wouldn't write it. Or I'd write it, but I wouldn't publish it. If the answer is no, I'd just go ahead and write it. And the truth is, as soon as he said that, Brendan, I could feel that I was no longer, again, I was turning 50 at the time. I could feel I was no longer angry at my father or my mother. I didn't even feel sorry for the boy I'd been or the childhood I'd had. They're a lot worse everywhere at all times. I just felt artistically compelled to try to capture what it was like to be in this dead mill town in the early 70s, Vietnam limping to a finish. We're all doing drugs and alcohol. We've got hair to our waist, and there are no men around, and there's all this dysfunction and violence. And it was the world that shaped me, and I finally just felt I found a way in, and then my strategy was, okay, I'm going to shine a light on my family, but only when their experience intersects my own. So, for example, my brother was sexually abused, daily by this grown woman for 6 years, from 13 to 19. He was like a kept boy. And you know, so if I'm walking by my 14-year-old brother's bedroom at 4 o'clock on a Thursday afternoon and I hear the moaning of, you know, a grown woman having sex on the other side, I'm not going to go on the other side of that door because that's his memoir. That's his story to tell. But you know what? In the hallway, the moans are part of mine. And that became my strategy. And then it got better. It became a much more honest and symphonically rich story to tell. And it was my editor who was tough on it. She wouldn't let up. Said, no, this is... And here's the thing, man. And you know, I talk about this almost too much. But the central thing about writing I find most joyous is that it's an act of discovery. It's not an act of exposition, which, as you know, means to show. Mm-hmm. You know, showing all the smart things you've learned. Who cares about the writer? It's not an act of exposition. It's an act of discovery. I love that line from the late, great short story writer Grace Paley. We write what we don't know we know. The truth is, all those years, for years, I thought I'd become a far more effective street fighter than I should have been. Because, you know, I'm not a tough guy. I'm not a big guy. I'm physically strong. I'm in shape. But I'm, you know, there are tougher guys within a one-mile radius of wherever I am at all times. I was so insanely, toxically full of self-hatred, I would rather die a violent death than see a coward in the mirror anymore. Mm. And that made me very dangerous for about a decade. But all those years, Brendan, I thought, until I wrote Townie, this accidental memoir that rose from an essay, I thought, well, I got dangerous because I learned how to channel, I learned how to box, and I learned how to fight, and I learned how to, you know, do all that. And it was the rage of the bullied boy. No, wrong. What writing Townie taught me, and again, and this is what I try to teach in memoir writing classes, and when I talk about creative writing nonfiction to writing students, is you must be as authentically curious about your own experience as you are as if you're writing a novel. And what I learned going back, putting the pieces back together of my own story, once I stepped back into The Wreck from the Adrian Rich poem, what did I discover? Oh, yeah, well, and once I let in with the editor's note, I let in that my brother was being sexually abused on a daily basis for 6 years. He tried to kill himself like 10 times before his late 20s. I left that out. I left out that my mother was so depressed. She was, you know, she worked 14 hours a day. She'd come home, she'd lie on the floor in her work clothes, fall asleep. She felt like an older sister. She had no friends. Her family was 2,000 miles away. Nobody. She was isolated. I left that out. I left out that my sister was raped and was selling drugs. I left out my other sister was so depressed and isolated. She put a padlock on her bedroom door because the house was full of degenerates. And when we came home from school, drug dealers my sister knew. I left that out. I left it all out. And then I put it back in. And then I kept digging and found more. And here's the thing. That's what I was putting into my fists. All of that. Mm. All of that. You know? And so... It's what I love about, you know, I'm working on a collection of essays right now that I hope to deliver to my publisher before the year's over. I've published like 30 of them already over the years. And I love it about the essay. You know, it just, you know, as you know, it comes from Montaigne, comes from the French essayé, to attempt or to try. I love that form that, you know, in the same way that poetry captures things that need poetry to capture them. You know, the way the light hits the side of your mother's face on that porch. You know, you don't need a novel. I just need a moment. Mm. I need this poem. The essay does the same, you know. What was it like? What was it like to be in that afternoon when blah, 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 you know? It's a beautiful thing.
And, you know, you had said that you had experimented a lot with trying to take a lot of what became Townie and write a lot of false starts in fiction, and then it finally coalesced in the nonfiction account. So why do you think there were so many false starts in fiction and then it ultimately became a nonfiction account?
I think there are at least two or three different kinds of writers, if not a lot more than that. But, you know, there are those who tend to be more auditory. You know, I think Faulkner had to hear those sentences in his head. You could say Hemingway was more painterly and very imagistic. In fact, he would study landscapes at the Louvre to learn how to write landscapes. You know, John Irving said there are at least two kinds of novelists. There are those who are sort of tragic and somber in tone, and those who are more comic, and he put himself in, you know, Charles Dickens in the more comic vein, as would be Mark Twain, etc. So then, what am I saying? And then there are those, this is my little theory, there are those writers who can write derivatively from their life experience and make beautiful fiction out of it. Truman Capote could have a bad cocktail party in Manhattan and write a beautiful short story about a bad cocktail party in Manhattan. My own father, the great short story master Andre Debuse, so much of his writing was derivative. I mean, I could point out, oh, well, that's his ex-wife from his second marriage. Oh, that's me. Oh, that's, you know, my sister. You know, Tim O'Brien writes beautifully from experiences he's had directly. But then there are those of us who seem to do a lot better when we go far afield. And I finally learned after many years of trying and failing that I tend to do better as a fiction writer when I really step into the private skin of someone I'll never be, like a female stripper in a Florida club, or like a Saudi Arabian, or like an Iranian, or like a little girl. I do better when I'm not writing close to home, at least in terms of factual experience. That's my answer, is I do a lot better when it's not remotely tied to anything I've experienced. But here's the thing, man. But then, I love what Doctorow said. You know, Sarah Orne Jewett, as you know, is the one who said, you know, write what you know. Doctorow said, yeah, but how do you know what you know? And so, doctor said, yeah, but how do you know what you know? You know, my first published story was from the point of view of an inmate out on a date with a woman for the first time in 7 years, because he was in the joint for 7 years. And I got letters from inmates, you know, it was in Playboy magazine, so that's how they read it. I got letters from like a handful asking where I'd done time or where I was doing time. And it made me feel so good because it was my first story. And I thought, well, maybe I wrote that pretty well. I think I was an inmate. And the truth is, I'd never, at that point, had never stepped foot inside of a state prison. But I have since, but not then. But the truth is, I knew what it was like to be a new kid in a schoolyard getting ready to get beat up just because I was new. It wasn't a huge emotional stretch to imagine what it's like to be raped or stabbed in the prison yard. And so we still end up, what I'm getting at is, you don't have to write about your direct life experience to still end up singing your song. You're going to do it emotionally anyway, but in my case, it tends to come out a lot better when it's, you know, from the points of view of characters and situations I've never been in.
What did it do for you when there's a great little scene in Townie? You get a knock on the door, and your father had called a phone booth from outside, and you know, he got wind of the story you had written, and he's just like, "You're a writer, man." Like, what did that mean to you when you heard him say those words?
Well, it was layered as hell, I'll tell you. I hope I got some of these layers into that book. On one level, it was I acknowledged that I was beginning to read his work, so I was beginning to discover how good he actually was at this thing. And so I took it as encouragement from a master to this puppy apprentice that maybe I was on the right road. You know, as you know, when we're in our late teens, early 20s, we're all desperate for some sign from some older, helpful person. Am I on the right path? Is this what I should be doing? You know, by the way, I take that responsibility immensely seriously with young people. And so there was that part of it, but there's also the part of having not really grown up around him. You know, he left when I was 10. You know, there was that part, it was just that father-son part where, as the son, I was just desperate to get any sort of appraising attention from it all. Not praise, but an appraisal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I wanted to be measured by him in some way. You know, and I know it's a term we throw around now, but it's actually, you know, I think very accurate. I just wanted to be seen by my old man. And that moment, all those came together in that one comment, "You're a writer, man." And that just, you know, I was high on that feeling for quite a while.
Yeah,
it gave me courage to keep doing it for a while.
Yeah, artists on any level, no matter what your discipline, something like that, a little bit of validation just puts so much fuel in the tank to just say, keep going. And,
it can help, you know, one comment can help you for years.
Yeah.
You know, especially once you start to get all the damn rejections, and I got a shitload. You know, people understandably think, well, it must have been easier for him with the same name, doors must have opened. I think they closed. You know, my first book went to, well, my first book had seven stories in it, three of which have been published in magazines or quarterlies. For those three acceptances, I had 117 rejections. You know, the book went to 39 publishers over 5.5 years or whatever. And, you know, I think people understandably thought, you know, he's like, I love Hemingway. You know, if someone handed me a copy of a story by Ernest Hemingway III or Jr., I wouldn't even want to read it. Screw you. I got my own Hemingway. Why don't you go sell cars or something? And I think I got a lot of that, which is understandable.
Oh, man.
Although it hurt my feelings for about 20 years, but that's okay.
Yeah.
We all get a hand we're supposed to play.
Yeah, and, you know, I've read, and I think it was in... it was either in Townie or The Descent. You say you value, you know, deep revision in that process. Yeah. And I wonder, like, how do you, you know, process that and work through ugly middles and get to the point where you are confident in a piece?
Well, you know, honestly, Brendan, boy, I never get to the point where I'm confident. I get to the point where I'm getting ready right after we talk to press send and send this new novel to my publisher in New York. And the feeling is, oh, well, the feeling always is, well, a better writer would have written a better book, but this is the best I can do. I have written it and rewritten it and rewritten it. And I have, you know, there's a great line from Raymond Carver. He said, you know, the kind of care I like is when the writer takes out all the commas and then puts them right back where they were again.
Yeah.
You know, so to answer your question, I think one of my favorite parts of the whole creative writing process, whether it's nonfiction or fiction, is revision. You know, and as we all know, it means to see again. Well, not just, gee, do I need to rewrite the sentence? Certainly line editing is important, but also, I don't know, do I need all 85 pages of this boy's memory of that year? And the truth is, usually no. You know, and too many writers, understandably, again, are loath to cut it because that was 14 months of my life. It took me 14 months to write those 85 pages. Yeah, you know what, though? But the reader only needs three of them. One of my favorite lines, and it's a really harsh line, is from Blaise Pascal, who said, look, anything written to please the author is worthless. You know, it's so harsh. But I do believe you must embrace that line, especially when you're revising. Just because it took you 2 years to write these 100 pages doesn't mean we need them in the narrative. But it's not wasted time, right?
Right.
That what you learned in those 100 pages are now going to fill what you leave out in that whole thing that Hemingway was a master at with the iceberg and 1/8 is showing, 7/8 is beneath the surface. Well, that 7/8 beneath the surface is what the writer knows but has left out. It takes great discipline, and frankly, an immense act of generosity, a word I don't think we use enough in creative writing discussions, for the reader. Not only generosity for the reader, but you know, which is counterintuitive, right? Because you're giving the reader less. But it's an act of generosity to give the reader less because you're actually trusting him or her to bring their life experience to the reading. And they can feel what is not there, they will sense and feel and know from their own lives. And that's part of the art.
And how would you describe the tenacity it takes to survive and thrive as a writer?
Well, look, man, it's different for everybody, right? You know, one of my favorite lines about this is from our wonderful American novelist who still isn't read nearly enough, Thomas Williams, won the National Book Award for his novel, The Hair of Harold Rue, in 1975, a beautiful book about writing, the writing life, by the way. Have you read it?
I have not.
Check it out.
Yeah.
Hair, like hair on your head. The Hair of Harold Rue, R-O-U-X. There's actually, I believe, USA, it'll come to me, the publisher. Bloomsbury Books did, a reissue of it, and I wrote the new afterward. Anyway, it's a beautiful book.
Cool.
Late in his life, Mr. Williams was asked, why do you write? He said, oh, that's easy. I write so I don't die before I'm dead. Isn't that great? I think that most real writers, I'm not talking about real as in having had any publishing success. You know you're a writer if, you know, people say, well, I don't know if I'm a writer. I said, well, can you go a year without writing and feel just fine? Yes. Well, and you're not a writer. Good. Go do something else. Now you're free to go do something else. But if, you know, if the answer is no, if I go 3 days without writing, I feel fucked up and, you know, depressed and a little cranky, well, you're probably a writer. But when you talk about tenacity, I do think that something has come into the culture that I think is kind of ominous. Now, I'm a bit of a broken record on this, forgive me. I hate the digital world. You know, I don't hate the podcast. I don't hate Google. I don't hate the internet. I hate the handheld device. I detest the iPhone. I detest that human beings are walking around staring at gadgets in their hands instead of looking into each other's eyes or checking out the sunset on the side of that dumpster in that Brooklyn alley that, you know, your cab just drove by. But guess what? You missed it because you're looking at social media. Mm-hmm. Social media, Facebook, I'm not putting them down. I'm sure there's value to them. I've had nothing to do with any of it. It's not because I'm a snob. It seems like a time killer when you could be reading a book or talking to a loved one. I've never texted. I'm never going to text. Here's my point. When you talk, one thing that I've seen polluting the writer's life, especially young writers, the first 10 or so years of doing it, is, you know, Facebook has made everyone the curator of the museum of me. Everybody seems to be taking selfies and posting them and taking little movies of themselves. What's happened is, and of course this is not an original thought, but I don't think it's helpful for the writer. It's made us even more self-involved and narcissistic than people tend to be. It's made us more neurotic. I'll tell you, that is the opposite energy the writer needs. You know, what is that great line? I'm going to butcher it from Flannery O'Connor, but something like, no art is sunk in the self. The one about the self needs to be self-forgetful in order to see the thing being seen and the thing being made. So if you want tenacity, get the fuck off social media. Because what this is going to do is it's made people less patient about their own failures. It's made people crave instant gratification more. And you know, I'm sorry. I think the muscles it builds are that's a bad metaphor. I think it atrophies any muscle you need to be tenacious because it's making us less patient, more self-involved. A great book can take 10 years to write, maybe longer. And you must find a way to do that without caring about the world ever noticing whether you write or not, or if you're gifted or not. You know, there's a great line I love from a Nadine Gordimer novel, A Son's Story, where one character has an insight as to what sincerity is. And she's talking to her friend, and we're in the character's point of view, and she thinks, oh, sincerity is never having an idea of oneself. I think that's beautiful. And the truth is, if you want to be tenacious, stop thinking, get the word career out of your head, get the word book out of your head, get the word publisher out of your head. Now, don't get me wrong. I wish that on all hardworking writers that they have some kind of worldly success. But I think that too often it's in the forefront of a writer's psyche these days. And that's just a recipe for hamstringing your tenacity.
It's too much of a, and it's hard to do this, especially in this country, of being ambitious and outcome-driven versus being process-driven, which I think is kind of what you're getting at, too.
well, you just said it much more economically than I did, Brendan. That was good. Yeah, what you said.
And, you know, you said something wonderful about being patient with failure. And it's something I like talking about with people is like the value of the drawer. You know, sometimes something needs to go sit in the drawer for a while, you know, and however long that might be. And I wonder maybe what your experience is with letting something that you've maybe rushed to write, but then you're like, it didn't feel right. So you just put it away and then it came back better than ever.
I would say I don't think I'm exaggerating when I say this. I think 95% of whatever I've put out in the world writing-wise are the phoenixes that rose from the ashes of what failed.
Mm.
You know, I have been writing 5-6 days a week without fail since I was 22. That's 35 years. I've only published 6 books. Where the hell have I been? Well, I've probably written 6 others, too, but no one's seen them. Because I had to write them. There's a great line from Gail Godwin, the writer has to clear her throat before she sings. You know, so much of this is a cooperating with what we find. And, you know, and if I say nothing, and I especially felt this writing my memoir and when I write personal essays, it always goes deeper and better, the writing does. And it always comes out to be something I'm more proud of than ashamed of. Not when I set out trying to say something about something I experienced, etc., or something I know or learned. Who cares? No, It's when I've set out to find something. That is when something really special happens. And so many early drafts, back to your comment about the value of the drawer, they go in the drawer because I was too willful. I was controlling it too much. I was trying to say something, and it was just a one-note treatment of something. I had to let go and really wait for the honest and authentically curious way in. I think you're totally correct. And also, there's another thing about Americans. We're very impatient with failure. You know, we don't tolerate it in ourselves or others. You know, I think we still do break our culture down into winners and losers. And look what we did. We elevated a man to the highest office in the land who literally breaks people down into winners and losers. And who are the winners? Rich white males.
Yeah.
And the rest of us are losers. And he actually uses those terms, winners and losers, which is toxic. But the truth is, if you want to write or create anything worth a damn, you better embrace failure, or you're not going to get to the good stuff.
Yeah, and I think, I sometimes default to, like most men do anyway, to a sport metaphor. And, in baseball, you're a Hall of Famer, not if you bat 300, but if you fail 70% of the time. And, in horse racing.
That's a good sports metaphor, buddy.
Yeah. And in horse racing, a Hall of Fame horse trainer, if he's winning at 18% of the time, so failing 82% of the time, like, he'll be a Hall of Fame horse trainer. So it's like, when you flip it on the other, you can embrace failure as a means to success, but it's hard to get there sometimes. You know, just have the highlight reel to compare ourselves to.
Yeah, and I think that what is the task before us? I think the task before each of us, people who do this creative writing thing, you got to learn to love how hard it is. You know, for years, you know, if you read Tony, you know that I worked really hard on trying to build a big, strong body, and you know, I never had the genetics to get big, but mm-hmm. I've always been pretty in shape. Well, now since I started working out in 1974, I haven't quit. So I'm a lot stronger than I look. What's my point? I was a student of the bench press because all I wanted to do was bench press 300 to 500 pounds. Mm. I got close to 300, but I never got beyond it. And I never, you know, I never got heavier than about 165 pounds of body weight. My point is, I read this one article by this really good bodybuilder. He said, when I started to get really good at bench pressing is when I began to fall in love with how scared I was lowering a heavy weight to my chest. He said, I began to fall in love with the fear, and I began to fall in love with that feeling of the pectoral muscles stretching almost to the breaking point as I lowered that heavy bar. He said, once I began to look forward to the fear and the physical pain, I got really better at bench pressing. And so I do think that, so here's another great line I love from some ancient Chinese wise person. If the mad dog comes at you, whistle for him.
Huh.
Right?
Yeah.
Dennis Lehane's an old friend, and I saw him once give a talk, and actually to my students at UMass, and he said, you know, when I look back and I think about all the buddies I had who started writing when I did and how they didn't keep it up, and he said, I asked myself, well, how have I kept it up? And he said, oh, I know, fear management. Every day I manage my fear. And, you know, these are important thoughts because, most of us have jobs that we're not afraid of. We have stress. Everyone's got stress. But, you know, it's a gift to have a job that still scares you after decades of doing it, as it scares me, you know, stepping into the unknown. But I've learned to love that fear. You know, there's a have you read The Writing Life by Andy Dillard?
It's on my shelf. I have not read it yet.
Yeah, go read it this summer. You'll read it in 2 hours. It's a lovely, slim volume, so smart. In one passage, she's describing Giacometti. I talk about this in that essay you read, The Descent.
Yep.
And I love how she talks about if Giacometti had not acknowledged his bewilderment, he would not have persisted. And once again, I don't think it's something in American culture anyway, the culture I know best, you know, we don't tell kids to go get lost. And we sadly tell them to go get lost, but we don't prize being lost. We don't prize bewilderment. You know, you're supposed to figure shit out. Well, no, don't. you know, Flannery O'Connor, there's a certain grain of stupidity the writer can hardly do without. Hmm. And that's the quality of having to stare. I think once the writer begins to embrace bewilderment and the fear that goes along with it, joyously, that's when real growth happens. And that's when that tenacity that you talked about happens. And that's when the patience that is required to create something beautiful, I think, kicks in. And then what becomes far more important is the daily writing. And you're not so much thinking about being an author as you are a writer. And then all over the years, I've seen those who can do all that end up being authors.
And how have you, you know, you said you've, you know, been writing 4, 5 to 6 days a week, you know, since you were 22. So, you know, 35 years of that. How do you, how did you bake that into your day? And what's your routine like to ensure that you're getting those mountains of words written?
Yeah, well, that's, there's the rub right there, brother. Sometimes it's not a mountain of words. Sometimes it's five, 14.
But it's words.
You know, I have this metaphor, which is probably creepy, but I think that whether you're male or female writer, that you're pregnant with that story or essay or memoir, novel, what have you. You are pregnant with it the way a real woman is pregnant with a real child in her real womb. And your job is just to get daily nutrients to it. No matter how you feel about it, you gotta feed the baby. Well, how do you do that? You show up and you get in a session. Now, you know, the novel that put me on the map, House of Sand and Fog, I wrote in a park car in a graveyard not far from my house because we had three little kids. I was in a tiny apartment. I wasn't going to tell them to be quiet so Daddy could write. So I wrote in my car. And during those years, I was working, teaching at 4 or 5 campuses and as an adjunct writing professor in Boston. I was also remodeling houses as a carpenter where I made more income. I was a sole provider financially. And I had no time. I had such good excuses to never get any writing done. I was also getting 4 or 5 hours sleep a night. But still, I would pull up in that graveyard and, you know, 5 in the morning, you know, engine running, coffee in my hand, no sleep, and I would write a paragraph. You know, I'd write for about like 17 minutes. I'd go to the job, whether it was carpentry, teaching, or both. On the way back, I'd go to the graveyard again. I'd write another 17, 18 minutes. And I did that for 3 years. And after 3 years, I had 22 notebooks filled, a beginning, middle, and an end. So at the height of my our young, struggling family life, I was able to write, you know, an entire novel. And I think anyone can do it. You don't need all day.
Yeah.
Now, that said, I'm glad those years have come and gone. They were joyous in a exhausting way. But now I've got a great schedule. You know, I only teach twice a week, even on those days I write, because I teach in the afternoon. So I get down to my cave. I have a soundproof room in my basement. I bring my coffee. I shut the door. It's a cave. It's 5 feet wide, 11 feet long, 6 foot ceiling. I cover the one window with a blanket. I work at a wooden desk facing a blank wall. I write longhand pencil and notebooks. But I begin by reading poetry, which I've been doing for many, many, many years. I'm a huge consumer of poetry, and I read 2 to 3, 4 poems just to get me into a state. And frankly, it's inspiring. And then I start writing. And when I'm composing from scratch, I will write for no more than 2, 2.5 hours. I'm shot after that. I'm done. There's no concentration left. I'll go work out, clear my head, and then go, you know, juggle all the things that need doing, you know, to pay the bills, to be a husband, a father, a friend, a son, a brother, etc. And in the morning, next morning, I go back and I do it again. But, you know, I type the previous day's handwriting into the computer, push it aside, and continue to write longhand. You know, you don't need to write all day. You know, it's a rare writer who can, you know. You know, Larry McMurtry, one of our most prolific novelists, 90 minutes a day, but every day, 90 minutes. Graham Greene, who wrote, 40-plus novels, 2 hours every morning on the French Riviera. I don't know how he got any writing done on the French Riviera, but he did. 2 hours every morning.
So what are some book or books that you reread over and over again to get into, X-ray read it, to get into the bones of it?
One of my favorite contemporary novels is Ironweed by William Kennedy. Have you read that one?
No.
It's a beautiful one. It won a Pulitzer Prize, I think, in 85 or 86. It's just stunningly put together. Another one, and, you know, he was a young writer, and have you read the stories of Brice DJ Pancake?
No. Oh, man. You're giving me a reading list.
Yeah, man, Pancake. There was a reissue, I think, Back Bay Books did. I actually wrote the new afterword for that one. Somebody gave me, a good writer friend gave me a copy of his story, Trilobites. Pancake died, killed himself when he was 26 or 27 years old. He left behind these short stories. His mother sent him around, a lot like the John Kennedy O'Toole story, and they got published. And then guess what? They were finalists of Pulitzer Prize for Fiction. He was a beautiful, gifted writer. He wrote so deeply and honestly about what he knew, which was the coal mining haulers. He grew up in West Virginia. And so I reread that book a few times just for the honest voice and vision. And read his story, Trilobites.
Yeah.
Another one, I'm a big Doctorow fan. I reread a lot of his stuff. Lately, I've read The March a couple of times. But the one that I go back to, you know what I go back to a lot, is Hemingway's short stories. And I reread them many times, and it's, again, the economy and the containment and the restraint. It was really something. And I think I've read The Sun Also Rises 6 times. And who else? There's so much great writing right now. I have to say, probably my favorite living American writer right now is Elizabeth Strout. I can't get over the quality of her prose. If you have not read My Name is Lucy Barton, talk about restraint and trusting the reader to get the blank spaces. That is one of the most psychically naked books I've ever read. It's stunning. And of course there are more that I'm not thinking of.
Yeah.
There's such great writing out there. And by the way, I don't understand writers who get discouraged when they read great writing or competitive or envious. I feel nothing but gratitude. I just feel grateful somebody pulled it off. Oh my God, now I want to try to.
That's incredible. Yeah, I wanted to ask you about, sometimes there's an inherent jealousy among artists. And I think you said the one thing that is the force field against that feeling is not to be competitive or jealous, but to approach it with that sense of gratitude and wonder and positivity, right?
Yeah, I mean, I don't. I mean, look, I've had fallen human moments where, I've seen a writer elevated who I didn't think deserved the elevation, say. So I've had those bitter moments of, oh, man, that guy, he's not even that good. Are you kidding me? But, I try to, George Garrett has a great line. He said, all that crap that writers are guilty of sometimes, of envy or jealousy or greed. He said, try to contend with all of that in the head, but don't let it get into the heart.
Mm.
I think that's profoundly wise advice. But the truth is, it's a rare moment for me to feel those things. I'm not, I've got other human flaws, but the truth is, it's hard to write a book, really hard. And I trust that everyone's doing the best they know how. And when someone really pulls it off artistically, I just feel joy. When I'm, again, one of the great successes in publishing the last few years have been is Anthony Doerr's All the Light We Cannot See. Have you read that?
It's on the shelf. Yeah, yeah.
Okay, Brendan, that is a friggin' masterpiece. Mm-hmm. It took him 11 years to write, too. 11
yep.
years. It deserves every accolade and success it's getting and more. I felt nothing but joy. Seeing that, because it was one of the books that just made me glad to be alive and have eyesight and a reading habit.
Yeah. And lastly, before I let you get out of here, Andre, you had written in Towny that writing had given me. And I wonder if you could just maybe speak to that and what that means for someone who might be, we kind of alluded to being outcome driven and all that stuff. And I think that sentence there kind of grounds writing of what it should and could be for a lot of people.
Yeah.
If they just kind of got the book out of their head and just did the work.
Yeah. Thank you, Brendan, for that question. Cause it's a profoundly important one. Look, I think someone is profoundly fortunate if they find early in their lives or in his or her life, as I did in mine, that thing that makes him or her themselves. For me, when I discovered writing at age 22, creative writing, I felt like me for the first time. So, okay, here I am. Mm. You know, I give a lot of convincing speeches, and I keep saying the same thing, which is, look, I don't wish success on you guys. I don't want you to go out there and be a winner. I want you to go out there and be joyous and grow, because that's the only way you're going to be joyous is to grow. And how are you going to grow? To do that thing or those things that when you do them, you're more you than when you do not. Joseph Campbell wrote about that beautifully when he talked about following the bliss and all that, and the power and the myth. Look, what is, we live in this culture that prizes, that celebrates, you know, famous writers and actors and directors, and, you know, they give you a lot of attention and love once you've had success, but it's not a culture that helps you grow as a writer until you've had it. In fact, they belittle it. Families love their kids, but I can't tell you how many, you know, I work with a 90-year-old woman and she started writing, she couldn't start writing until her parents died because they didn't want her to suffer in the writing life. Here's my point. Too often what is keeping people from doing it and rushing it, wanting that success, is they're trying to please others. Too often, I think we make daily choices because we're imagining that family gathering in the future 3 years from now where I get to say, well, I'm doing this and I've done that to some aunt you hardly even know. And the truth is our lives are short. We live 100 years. It ain't long enough. And you're only given one. So if you are fortunate enough to have found, say, creative writing, and you know that you're not going to be you if you don't get in those daily words, then that's all you need to know. You need to do that or you're going to die before you're dead. And by the way, let's just talk about that desire to give to the culture. Jean Reese has a beautiful image. We can end with this. Jean Reese. She said, you know, and look, I'm not poo-pooing the desire to publish. I think it's a beautiful desire. It means you want to be part of the conversation. But Jean Reese said it so much more beautifully in this image. She said, look, she said, if culture is a big ocean, and then there are great rivers that flow into it like Mozart and Shakespeare and Claude Monet. She said, but there are also my 5 novels. Which are, it's a trickle of a stream, but they go into the same ocean. And I think that's really such a beautiful image because it's really what's behind, you know, the secondary pleasure of writing, which is wanting to have people read it. We just want to be part of the cultural conversation. And that's a beautiful impulse, but it ain't ever going to happen if you got one eye in the mirror to see how you're doing. You must embrace the fact you will not be on the planet forever. May everybody live 140 years. But... you know, and you must get in the words. Just show up.
Well, thank you so much, Andre, for carving out time in your morning here to talk shop.
My pleasure.
Yeah. So, hey, safe travels, and we'll be in touch down the road. Thank you so much again.
All right, man. I really enjoyed your questions, and let's have a beer sometime. You're back east.
Fantastic. We'll do it.
All right.
Take care. Good luck finding Andre on social media. He ain't there. He's writing and getting the work done. We could all learn from that, right? So thanks, big thanks to Andre for coming on the podcast and talking so candidly and openly about his work and the generosity it takes to be a part of the writing community. It's quite inspiring listening to him talk. So lastly, you know, I wonder how confident he is that I can get my wife to actually subscribe to my own podcast.
Well, you know, honestly, Brendan, boy, I never get to the point where I'm confident.
Yeah, that's kind of what I thought, right? Anyway, thanks very much for listening. Tune in next week for another episode of the Creative Nonfiction Podcast. I'm Brendan O'Mara. Thanks again.